also the cherubs were stood upon the, or knelt upon the Ark of the Covenant. Between the wings of the cherubs came Shekinah's glory, the presence of the Lord. The word cherub from cherub means an ox or a bull. And we know that in ancient Jewish symbolism, the cherubim were represented with four heads, a lion, a bull, a man, and an eagle. These are the four fixed signs of the zodiac, Taurus, Leo, Scorpio, and Aquarius. And they are also placed on the corners of early Christian graves, or sarcophagi. And the old nursery rhyme, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, bless the couch that I lie on. And here are the four animals. And of course you know that those four animals, the four fixed signs of the zodiac, were also associated with the evangelists. And at the present time I'm working an article for Horizon, which is going to deal with the lion of St. Mark. There is one of your four signs. Each of the apostles had one of the four evangelists had these four creatures, the four fixed signs of the zodiac, assigned to them. Thus these symbols go on, and we find them not only in ancient times, but in more recent religious history. Now after a length of time, 2160 years to be exact, the precession of the equinoxes retired till it reached the last degree of the sign of Aries. And we find the beginning of a new religion, a new concept of religion. And it is interesting that it should have arisen about 1700 or 1800 years before the beginning of the Christian era. For it was at that time, according to the old tradition, that the great mysteries of the Greeks at Eleusis were brought into existence. Perhaps this date is traditional. Perhaps it is astronomical. But the fact is that it served the symbolic purpose. For at that time it is said that at the time of the vernal equinox, always the time of greatest importance in ancient festival, the Hierophant of the Rites of Eleusis came forth upon the porch of the temple, carrying in one hand the shepherd's crook, and in his other, in the hollow of his left arm, a newborn lamb. And he held up the shepherd's crook and elevated the lamb to the admiration of the people. And 1800 years before the beginning of the Christian era, he cried out in a loud, very loud voice, "All hail, Lamb of God, that taketh away the sin of the world." Now this lamb is very interesting. This is the Paschal lamb. This is also the lamb associated with the rites of Jupiter Ammon, the ram-headed god of the ancient Egyptian, Latin, Greek peoples. Also, this was the ram's horns upon the forehead of the crown of the north and south of the ancient Egyptians. This was the scapegoat of Israel. And here also we have the offering of the lamb as an offering to the Lord in the sacrifice of Isaac. We have also many references to the blood of the lamb, purification by the lamb, the heart of the lamb, the Angus Dei. And we find the rites and rituals of the lamb and the symbolism of it, Jason and the golden fleece. For the golden fleece was the symbol of the curtain of the mysteries. And this was the wool that was pulled over the eyes of the unworthy, the symbol of secrecy, the symbol of ritualism. The search for the golden fleece was man's search for truth. Here is the lambskin apron of the ancient Masonic guilds of operative masonry in the Middle Ages. Here are many, many symbols dealing with the mystery of the lamb. And then there came a time when again the equinox continued in its precessional motion, and the sun at the great moment of the equinox moved from the first degree of the sign of the lamb to the last degree of the sign of the fishes. And when it occurred, when this happened, It entered into the sign, which is ruled over by two small fishes. And here we come also to one of the most important points in the entire system of astronomical religion. And that is that the sign of the fishes is the last sign of the zodiac. The sign of the ram is the first. Now someone will say, why? How are you going to divide a circle into first and last? By what strange figuring did men come to the conclusion that Aries was the first sign? The answer goes back to the Vedic researches of India, where it is said that at the beginning of another great age that lasts much longer than the photonic year, that at the beginning of a very great cycle of 4,320,000 years, that the original first point of a great cycle of time is established by the conjunction of the five planets and the two luminaries in one sign. This can only occur once in a vast cycle of mathematical calculation. And the last time that the seven met together was in the sign of Aries, by which another great cycle of calculation was established. They will then separate, as now, and move at various orbits and times through all the different parts of the heavens, forming innumerable combinations of themselves. And they will ultimately meet again. And in the next time that they meet, they will meet in the same element, one sign removed. In other words, Aries is the element of fire. But they will not meet in Leo, which is the next fire sign, but in Sagittarius. So the next great cycle will begin with the conjunction of the five planets and the two luminaries in Sagittarius, and that will measure another great cycle of world development. Within this cycle come the great yugas, the four ages, which were known as the gold, silver, iron, and bronze ages of the ancients. All these things were mathematical, astronomical phenomena. But for our present moment, we say that the sign of Aries is the beginning, and the sign of the fishes is the end of the zodiac. Thus, these two come together to form an interesting symbolism. And the sun god, or in this case, say, John on Patmos, describing the mysteries that were celebrated there, the Phrygian rites, causes the great being of the Phrygian mysteries to say, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Now, this also has very great interest because of two symbols particularly associated with Christianity. One is the fish. The first symbol of the Christians was a fish. And in Rome, they recognized each other by drawing the shape of the fish upon the sand. The name for fish was an acrostic on the name for Christ. St. Augustine says that Christ was a fish broiled for the sins of man. It's a very interesting symbolism. So we find Christ standing, calling the apostle, and saying, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. The miracle of the fishes, the drought of the fishes. The miracle of the coin in the fish's mouth. Many other miracles that relate to the story. And Jesus, in speaking, going forth upon a ship on the Sea of Galilee. The water symbol of the fish is very interesting. One of the ancient deities came forth out of the sea as Dagon, or the fish man. And the bishop's mitre of the Christian church is a fish's head on end. These things are important. For here we find a transition taking place. And at this transition of sign, the rising of a faith. A faith which had as its principal symbols the two principles, or two ideas, the Lamb of God and the Fisher of Men. The fisherman's ring is the ring of the Pope. The symbol of the papacy was the great fisherman, named from Peter, who was referred to not very long ago in a book called The Big Fisherman. He was the fisher of men, and this was the symbolism. Now, if you look in your zodiac, you will find that directly across from the sign of the fishes is its opposite. Each sign has its opposite, there being 12 signs. And the opposite sign to the fishes is the sign of Virgo, the Virgin. And the Assumption of the Virgin, the feast of the Assumption of the Virgin, takes place when the sun, the symbol of the principle of life, is in the sign of the Virgin. It's a very interesting parallel again. Now, the Virgin in ancient times was Ceres or Cori, the mother who was always still a virgin, because she brought forth immaculately the food, the earth, the grain, the flowers, the trees. Everything was born from her, but she was still the mother of mysteries, the eternal virgin. She was Isis, the mysterious being whose veil no man could lift. And this symbol in ancient astronomy carried in its arms either a sheath of grain, as Cori did, or sometimes the loaves of the Passover, or the unleavened bread. So we have an interesting thing. Jesus, the sun entering the symbol of the equinox and the sign of the fish, performed the miracle of feeding the multitude with two fishes and the barley loaves, and there were 12 baskets of scraps left. Again, the circle of the zodiac. Later, when the time came for the Master to prepare for the Passover, he sent a disciple into the city, and he said to him, "You will see a man who carries a pitcher of water on his shoulder. Follow that man. When he enters into a house, go in likewise, and go to the upper room and say that your master wishes it to celebrate the Passover." Who is the man with the pitcher of water on his shoulder? He is the Egyptian deity Canopus, the water man. He is also Aquarius, the water bearer, always represented in the ancient system of the zodiac as a man carrying a pitcher of water on his shoulder. He carried that pitcher of water long before the beginning of the Christian era. So the sun, moving on, goes into the new age, or the age that is to come, to celebrate again its passing over in the sign of the water bearer. Of course, the sign or the ritual of the Passover is the passing over of the sun at the time of the equinox. All these rituals have been very carefully measured to meet the astronomical requirements, like the epoch and the golden year and all these things. We have calculations to run through every one of these symbols. Now, one of the great questions that has arisen perhaps in our studies a little has been to determine, if possible, the time of the beginning of the age of the fishes, or what we call the Piscean Age. It is, of course, a nice, right, trite contrivance to say that it began with the beginning of the Christian era. But in India and in many other countries, a point is made with which some Western astronomers and astrologers will certainly be at variance. Namely, that at the present time, the equinox is taking place approximately in the 8th degree of the sign of the fishes. It hasn't left. It hasn't moved into this other age yet. If the Indian and the old Chaldeo-Babylonian calculation is correct, by a very curious thing, a circumstance that is almost too remarkable to be a coincidence, the vernal equinox should have entered the sign of the fishes approximately the year 325 AD. And that was the year of the establishment of the Christian Church by the Council of Nicaea. It would have ended at the time when the heaviest influence was in upon the quality of Leo, which also corresponded exactly. If from that point on you calculate each step of the precession of the equinoxes, from that time to the present day, you will find some very remarkable things if you break up the year as the ancient did. Now, if you take this period, the age of the fishes, and what is this age? Now you go back to your tables of Sargon, the king of Babylon, where the first delineations of the signs and planets are given. There's been no change in the readings of these symbols for nearly 4,000 years. And we find that the sign of the fishes was represented in that time, and still is in astrology, as a sign of water, the sign of retribution, the sign of the deluge, the sign of obscuration, the sign of karmic fulfillment, the sign of the end of an old way, the termination of patterns. In the great sun cycle in China, the deluge which ends the world is always associated with the sign of the fishes, and the reorganization or building of the new world naturally follows. But in this constellational diffusion, if we observe it carefully, there is a strangely psychological relationship between the keywords of the sign of the fishes and the strange state of our world ever since this strange equinoctial occurrence took place. The obscuration, the hiddenness, and at the same time, the strange spirituality which is associated with this sign, the mysticism, the inner and deeper yearning and longing, the age of the ministry, the age of the struggle, the strife, the pain, the problem, the winding up, the paying off of old debts, the completion of work left unfinished. And in many ways that is a bit typical of the situations we find ourselves in. Thus, we say, we have about 2,160 years to work with from the beginning of this cycle. And if we do assume for a moment that it could coincide with the Council of Nicaea, which was the formal creation of the Church, and we know that from the time of this Council on, the integration of the Church took place. It became a religion. Prior to that, it was a group of scattered communities without leadership or organization. If we add one half of the period of that cycle, if we divide this great period of 2,160 years right in half to divide the age into a positive and negative half, where does the half line drop? It drops approximately in the year 1400. In fact, it drops a little closer than that. It drops almost identically on the exact date set aside as the date of the Renaissance, the great change in our world, the beginning of the modern world as we know it, the moving from the negative half of the sign to the positive half. We break down the sign step by step, and we find everywhere that these major cycles hit exactly with the prominent dates in the cultural and moral and spiritual growth of our peoples. And it seems very possible that this was the basis, this study of the great Platonic year, was the basis of the fortunate long-range predictions of men like Nostradamus, who could not have worked it by the ordinary methods that we know, but only by the great precessional motion. Now, from all this, we come to many other symbols. And I think there is one that is fascinating enough to give a little thought to. During this period that we call the medieval world, there lived a very interesting and kindly old gentleman who is known as the Venerable Bede. He is called Venerable because he was on his way to canonization, but he never got any further than the first step by which he became Venerable, as one of these terms that precedes full canonization. Now, the Venerable Bede was a very pious soul, and he had a great sorrow in his heart, something that he just could hardly bear. And that was to contemplate the motion of a pagan heaven over a Christian earth. Here were all the constellations, here was the Argonaut sailing off, here was Cetus the great whale, here were all these symbols, Hercules and Pegasus and Ariadne and all this, all moving over a perfectly respectable Christian commonwealth. It just didn't seem right. So the Venerable Bede decided to Christianize the heavens. And he did it. And we have in the library two very beautiful astronomical charts, very large ones, original prints from the Middle Ages, in full color, showing the Christian universe. He did it very simply. He simply took the various constellations and transformed them. The Krator, or cup of the Greeks, became the Holy Grail. The 12 signs of the zodiac became the 12 disciples. Nothing could be simpler. Cetus, the great fish, Leviathan, became Jonah's whale. And the Argonaut kept on sailing as Noah's Ark. All these symbols were perfectly fitted together. And the result was a great success. But suddenly everybody stopped in their tracks. Somebody had let the cat out of the bag. Actually, the symbolism proved the common origin of both groups. Actually, these symbols that were put in the place of the old were the equivalents in a new faith of identically the same principles. So everybody hushed it up and forgot about it until the French Revolution came along with still a different idea, and the situation has lapsed back, waiting now for another revolution on the part of scientists who probably will want to change all of these because they can't stand the superstitions of any group. So that now you don't speak about planets, speak about signs, you speak about so many degrees of right ascension. It's so much less personal and so much more scientific, but it comes out to the same place. Also, astrology is now giving way to a kind of new science which is going to be called cosmography, or something of that nature, in which they're going to do something that was never heard of before. They're going to consider the possibility that the heavens influence the earth. And they're going to do it with a new name, and the right man is going to discover it, which is very, very important in our times. But this concept of the universe, again, shows much that tells us of the old ways and of the old concepts and rites. In the old days, the initiation rituals of the temples always followed in some mysterious manner this astronomical pattern. Apuleius, for example, in the Metamorphoses, describes his own initiation into the mysteries as far as he can. Then he says that to preserve his vows he must be silent. But he does explain that at one degree or part of the rite, this candidate is enveloped in a blue cloak covered with stars and constellations to indicate that he is being lifted up into the higher parts of the universe. Apuleius also tells us that in one of the degrees of the mysteries, he beheld the sun shining under his feet at midnight, which is a very interesting point, looking very much as though somebody knew something about the astronomical theory, because theoretically at midnight that's approximately where you might expect it to be. Also, he describes the rituals, and he follows very closely the description given by Porphyry in his Cave of the Nymphs, which is an interpretation of one section of the Odyssey of Homer. And he describes the cave of initiation, in which you descend under the earth, and come into a room, the ceiling of which is made to represent the sky. And there are two entrances, one on each side, and you descend a set of steps. You walk across a common ground and ascend out through another set of steps. And the point of entrance into this underworld is called Cancer. And the point of exit is called Capricorn. And the adventures, wanderings, and terrible experiences of the candidate seeking initiation represents the motion of the sun through the signs Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, and Sagittarius. Now, if you can imagine placing Cancer at one gate and Capricorn at the other, and going down now to the point between them, you will find you have sort of tipped your celestial globe so that now the bottom point is represented by the sign of Libra, which is now between the two. Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra. Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, you're out. So that Libra is placed at the center in the bottom. The sign of Libra is the scales. Here the soul, descending into the underworld, comes into the judgment hall of Osiris, where his consciousness or his conscience is weighed upon the scales in the psychostation. The ancient peoples only had a zodiac of 10 signs at one time in a very remote period. They had no sign of Libra, and Virgo Scorpio were one sign. And that is still indicated by the general shape of the two, except that in one the end of the M-like figure turns up, and in the other it turns back. Now, at the time of the so-called fall of man, it was believed that the signs were divided and Libra was inserted between them. There is a very ancient doctrine about that, increasing the number of the signs to 12. But the sign of the scales placed in the judgment hall of the twin truths in the temple of Amentet is at the bottom of this V-like pattern of the descent of man into judgment or into generation. This judgment or testing in the mysteries follows very closely the entire cycle of ancient times and the ancient initiation ritual. Now, there is also a very interesting story relating to the human embryo. For if the embryo is twisted inward to form its equivalent to a circle, the embryo, which has at the beginning, as you realize, a caudal appendage resembling a tail, looking very much like a highly developed polywog, this structure, if twisted into a circular form, equals 3/4 of a circle. In other words, it takes 9/12 of a circle to do this. But there are three signs or three parts of the circle that are not touched. The head and tail of the figure do not meet. Therefore, this occurs to us in our Old Testament symbolism under the story of the broken wheel. And this broken wheel, or the 9/12 wheel, is again an astronomical symbol that has played a considerable part in human thinking. Because the 9/12 represent the 9 months of generation, or the period in which the child is being formed. The three missing signs, or the broken spokes of the wheel, or the missing rim of the wheel at that point, fulfills the rites of the Eleusinian Mysteries. Well, the Eleusinian Mysteries were given in two sections, the 9 lesser and the 3 greater rites. The 9 lesser rites being the symbolical rites of generation, the 3 greater rites of regeneration. Therefore, by 9 months and 3 degrees, a man is made perfect. This is a very curious symbolism, but it has a great deal of interest if we know how to study it. In other words, the individual, to pass through the second birth, must go through the womb of the mysteries to complete the circle, of which nine parts only are provided in generation. The Chinese, fully aware of that, declare a child to be 1 year old after it has reached the third month. It celebrates its first birthday 3 months after it is born. This is part of a very curious doctrine. But it points to the three winter or fall months leading toward final death. It is to do with the blinding of Samson, the cutting off of the rays of the sun god. Also has to do, as Leonardo da Vinci points out in his astronomical calculation of the Last Supper. For the painting is a very strangely astute piece of work. And each of the apostles, in each of the positions and groupings, you will find the apostles are grouped in triplicities, exactly like the signs. And the sign of Scorpio is assigned to Judas. Now, why should the sign of Scorpio be assigned to Judas? In the Orient, there is something about the scorpion that is very peculiar. First of all, it stings with its tail. Therefore, it is the backbiter. The second thing that is about it that is strange is that the mark which it leaves is always in the form of a minute pair of human lips. The kiss of death. The kiss of betrayal. So that was the sign that was used to signify the destroyer, Typhon, who is also responsible for the destruction of the good god Osiris. The sign of the scorpion, however, in the ancient rituals has three meanings. Three creatures have been assigned to it down through the ages. And depending upon the one that is selected, you have some concept of the true meaning of it. The scorpion is one sign that is associated with it. The second sign that is associated with it is the serpent. The third sign that is associated with it is the phoenix. So the scorpion, the serpent, and the phoenix were all given to that one sign of the zodiac. And the Rosicrucian mysteries of old European mysticism always bestowed their higher rites at the time of the sun being in a certain degree of Scorpio. Therefore, Scorpio was the symbol of death and rebirth, of evil and redemption. Most of all, it was man transcending his own inferior nature. It was the symbol of initiation into the secret rites which symbolized death. It was the death of the old and birth into the new. It is death always leading to liberation. And we find all through the ancient symbolism these parallels carefully preserved even into your alchemical mysteries. And in the combinations and structures of the alchemical stone of the wise man, there is what is called the horoscope of the stone. In other words, there is a symbol of the universe represented as a particular pattern of planets. And in this pattern of planets, the formula for the stone of the philosopher and the elixir of life and the transmutation of metal is said to have been concealed. And the mysterious eight-sided vault of Christian Rosenkreutz was formed into the symbol of a solar system, in the midst of which the body of the ancient adept is said to have been placed. All of these peculiar symbols trail down through the ages, reminding us of the numerous forms of indebtedness that we have to the planetary symbols. The Dionysian artificers, the great builders of the Greek cathedrals and churches, and also the builders of the theaters of Dionysus. Later, they became the great Lombard builders of Europe, the builders of the medieval world and the Renaissance, the great Comocene masters. Nearly every one of the structures that they built was based mathematically upon a constellation. Cesarino, in his edition of Vitruvius, the great master of architecture, shows how the modes of architecture were based upon the great constellational patterns, and that the temples of the gods were built according to the stars of the constellations in which these gods were said to be enthroned. A very elaborate and involved system of architecture rose, therefore, from this same consideration. Also, we remember Gefero, the astrologer to Cardinal Richelieu, pointing out how the handwriting on the wall of heaven described in the Old Testament is actually a study of star groups in which the star constellations form the consonants of the Hebrew alphabet and the planets moving through them form the vowels. And the constant motion of the vowels and the consonants produce the writing upon the wall of sky which the ancient prophets could read. There are many references to these things, and gradually there emerges to our consideration a concept of sidereal motion, of human growth, and of the linking of these two together in a highly complicated scientific concept. The details of this were evolved over so long a period of time and with such astuteness that it is almost impossible for us to exhaust the research work that has come down to us. Unfortunately, of course, it has been largely mutilated, but enough remains to give us a tremendous amount of guidance if we actually want to have this guidance. We have other things that come out of this constellational study. The constellation, the oldest circular zodiac known, that which was found at Dendera in Egypt and is now in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, is a magnificent sandstone slab containing a study of the world, of the heavens, as they were known at that time. Many symbols and figures are included in this zodiac, which we no longer recognize or have any means of fully understanding. But we do have certain points that are very interesting. The Egyptians referred to what we call the Great Bear as the plow. It was the symbol of the turner of the furrows, and of course the ox of heaven was the one that drew the plow. This plow moved around the great polar star. And we have their knowledge now, which corresponds rather well with that of China and India, relating to the axis of this great system. According to the Egyptians and several other ancient peoples, the earth had more than two motions. Flammarion says 11. And I think the ancients were very near to that. They recognized particularly a peculiar oscillation of the pole, by means of which it seemed to point, hypothetically, at different times to various stars or near to various stars forming the Little Bear. Therefore, the ancients termed this constellation in India the Rishi, or the great sages, who at various times incarnated to become rulers of the earth. And of these great sages, one that we know perhaps the best is Vyasa, the great sage of the Mahabharata. This comes to us also in Egypt. The Egyptians, following many ancient peoples and following practices still held under certain circumstances today, were concerned with the mystery of the northern point of the heavens. They were never able to observe that the sun moved northward, in the sense of ever occupying the northern segment of the sky. It came nearer or further, but never did it do in the north what it did in the south, as far as their visual awareness was concerned. Therefore, the northern hemisphere, in the Egyptian ritual also, was represented as the direction of darkness. In the ancient temple, there was a gate at the east, west, and south, but no gate at the north. Now, as a result of that, it has been held that people believed that from what the Greeks call the Hyperborean, or the area or region north of the winds, Hyperboreus, that from this region came only frost and snow giants and monsters. The Egyptians, however, did not do it that way. They had a very interesting astronomical outlook, however. Measurements have been taken to study the glyph used in Egypt as the symbol of the great gods, particularly the abode of the great gods. This is always what appears to be an inverted bowl or a half circle, turned upon a straight line. In other words, the bowl bowls or bulges upward, forming a half circle. This is a boss, mountain, or raised place. And through that streaks a line like a vertical, not quite vertical staff. It is off the vertical. And at the upper end of that staff is a little flag symbol. This is like a little banner, a quadrangle. Apparently of cloth or something. The sign of a deity was always the staff with the flag, probably because in those days great and honored persons were accompanied by bearers of devices, heraldic symbols, much like the knight errants of the Middle Ages. But the thing that has always amazed students of Egyptology is the reason why in the abode of the great gods this flag staff cuts at an angle into this mountain or this mound. So somebody, for no good reason, perhaps it was Lepsius or one of the other early Egyptologists, began to study the inclination of this flag. And he examined a number of instances of it in great monuments. Of course, you can't be certain in hastily written documents by comparatively poor scribes, but in the great stone carvings, in the great sarcophagi texts, and so on. He studied these things, and he found this was always the same. And he measured a little further, and he found that it coincides exactly with our inclination of the Earth's axis. What is it then? This mountain and this flag represents the North Pole, which was the abode of the gods, the great gods, that dwelt in silence. And in Egypt, there was no symbol, no emblem, and no figure for the great gods. All the known gods, the gods of provinces, the creator gods, the cosmocrators, and the various Ammonian artificers, the creating gods that became later the Elohim of the opening chapters of Genesis, these deities are variously represented, sometimes with knives, representing the gougers, or the ones that carved matter out of space and formed worlds. Sometimes as Ptah, the potter of Memphis, forming the globe on a potter's wheel. Always the concept of the potter's wheel and its turning, however. They seem to be aware of that motion in their ancient rituals. A little later, further research indicated that on the great figures of Osiris, the plumed double crown of the North-South Empire was always worn at the same inclination. So the crown of Egypt corresponded in the inclination in relationship to the vertical, corresponded with that of the flag inclination on the mound, and also with the polar inclination. So here was an adornment, a symbol, tying to another principle, the principle of the pole and the polar mountain. Also, we know the Great Pyramid, by its orientation, was an astronomical marker of some nature or kind. The complex of pyramids have been regarded as probably the elements of a vast sundial system, similar in some ways to the complex of stones in England at Stonehenge, which was used by the Druids to determine the exact moment of the winter solstice. Here the great rituals were performed, particularly by capturing the ray of the newborn sun in a crystal lens in order to start the sacred fires by what we call burning glasses. All these symbols are intriguing, and the great gods of the north and the silence of these gods dwelling forever above the earth correspond, of course, to the Indian concept of Mount Meru, which is to the north. And in the Buddhist doctrine, Chang Shambhala, the city of the gods, means Chang, north. It means that it is the city of the north. And it is said that it is so glorious and so magnificent that lights are forever radiating from it. The Aurora Borealis. This house of the gods in the great north corresponds to the entire great concept of primitive Aryan myth and ritual. The ritual brought down from India along the migrations of the Aryans down the Indo-Gangetic plain long, long ago. Nor can we say that other peoples were not aware of these things. In your Central American complex of cultures, your pyramid builders and so on, you have great consideration given to the north and to the mystery that is hidden there. And the recognition that it has to do with the secret source of the universe, the great darkness from which light came. Because in all these systems, the great sun globe is always the child of heaven, the symbol of the first and only begotten of the veiled mother, who is space, whose mystery no man can solve. The sun gods then go into their infinite diversity of activities. But always the sun god is a child of fatality. And we have another interesting group of legends arising which are called the myth of the dangerous child. This is the child whose coming is predestined and looked forward to by the wise, whose birth darkness attempts to prevent by despotism, who finally rises triumphant over his enemies, becomes the ruler of his kingdom, is betrayed and dies, and is buried at the winter solstice. Buried, as the ancient legend tells us, over the brow of a hill. And here he remains until by 3 degrees or 3 days or 3 signs he is raised again at Easter. And this great cycle goes on and on and on. The cycle of the religious mystery of the sun divinity. Many times we find the solar face also. In among the Peruvians and among the peoples of the great South American complex that finally came under the control of the Inca chieftains, Viracana, the god of the air, was worshipped by kissing the sunbeam. All you did was face it and kiss the light, and that was your adoration for God. The symbol, the supreme symbol in that area, was the great golden disk of the sun. And the story is told that it was a disk of solid gold and jewels 11 feet in diameter. And when the conquistadors under Pizarro divided up the spoils, one of them got this sun disk as his spoil by a throw of dice, and a few moments later lost it to another soldier by another throw of dice. That was the way things were done in those days. But these people undoubtedly recognized the same basic concept. Their rites and ceremonies and what we learn of their religion shows that they also based all of their calculations upon the sovereignty of the solar power and its great journey. This is the dangerous journey of the sun, the hazardous journey, which is beset by all manner of problems, like the journey of Siegfried down the river, the great Rhine journey, that leads him finally to the house of the Gibichung, where he is betrayed and killed by Hagen, the symbol of winter, the dark one. These different emblems, and we find them everywhere, also show in the Maya complex. On the Casa de las Monas at Chichen Itza, Yucatan, the so-called House of the Nuns, there is over the doorway of the ecclesia, or small chapel, the Great One, Itzamna, the Lord of the Mysteries, he of the azure plumes of the Bird of Paradise. And he is seated in the solar egg, surrounded by rays of light going in all directions. He is the Great One, whose tabernacle is in the sun. Beneath him spread out the ancient Myra glyphs for water. Around him clouds and lightning. But he is the great solar one. Now later, from him, by an immaculate conception, by the virgin Xochiquetzal, was born Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the symbol of the sun's path and also of the same mysterious modes of the lunar arc which cause what we call today the dragon's head and tail in astrological research, the motion of the lunar orbit. And this great deity, Quetzalcoatl, was the good god, the sun god. He wore the bonnet of the Quetzal plumes, which was the symbol of the solar light rays, the feathers going out in all directions. For the Quetzal is the bird that is born of the sun, and when the time comes for it to die, it flies back to the sun. And the Quetzal, like the thunderbird of the American Indian, is just another phoenix. And this again is the symbol of priesthoods, the symbol of the wise ones, or the sun gods, the sun-born ones, who are the keepers of the ancient mysteries. And this Quetzalcoatl served his people well, brought them out of darkness and ignorance. But finally there came from the south the evil one, the red-mirrored god Tezcatlipoca, the god of Mars. And this evil deity destroyed the power of the sun god. And the sun god departed finally upon a raft of serpents from the shores at Veracruz, promising to return. But this whole cycle was a sun-Venus cycle. And the astronomy of these people proves it. The pyramid of the sun at Chichen Itza is an absolutely correct astronomical representation of the year. There are just as many steps on that pyramid as there are days in the year, and so on. All of these buildings astronomically built and oriented. And at the apex of the year, in the high point, was the temple to the deity. The deity itself represented by the feathered serpent or the dragon. And the feathered serpent, again, the symbol of the year, as in the Mexican calendar, where all the divisions on the calendar stone, the months of the year, are placed as scales upon the body of a serpent. Thus, every part of this mythology. And it is this same serpent, which is Python, which is slain by the sun god every year when he overcomes the year and becomes master of life or the keeper of the year. And every year also at the end, the year destroys him. And the new sun god must be born. So out of all of these concepts, perhaps you will have some general idea of the part that astronomy has played in religious symbolism. Now, we do not say that astronomy has given the meaning, but we do say that it has constituted the convenient symbolism and has rationalized and made authentic the outer structure of the mystical philosophy that is based upon the inner meaning of these symbols. And as we go through the series, we will try to explore that also, to find the ideas that are behind the use of these symbolic forms. But I'm afraid for that, you're going to have to wait till next week.